You are listening to the Krika Lecture Series podcast, produced by the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This and other Krika podcasts are available on SoundCloud and iTunes. For more information about Krika's lecture series and public events, visit our website at krika.wisc.edu.
Good afternoon. It's with great pleasure and joy that I get to introduce today's speaker to you. Ib Annus is Associate Professor with the Institute of Humanities at Tallinn University, Estonia, and she also lectures in the Department of Slavic and East European Languages and Cultures at Ohio State University. Her recent books include Soviet Postcolonial Studies, A View from the Western Borderlands, and Coloniality, Nationality, Modernity, a Postcolonial View on Baltic Cultures Under Soviet Rule. She is currently working on a manuscript, Environment and Society in Soviet Estonia, 1960 through 1990, and this book is under contract with Cambridge University Press. She is also the author of two novels. And I'm really excited and looking forward to this talk, so please help me welcome Ib Annus.
Hello everyone, and thank you so much for inviting me here, and thank you for organizing this beautiful weather for me. It was a special bonus. And I'm very excited to present this material today because actually at that point, as of 2 weeks ago, I can say this is my finished manuscript that's been submitted.
Congratulations.
Yes. And part of that material is also part of, or actually instead part of my next book project, which will be going in somewhat different direction. But let me first of all just give you a couple of keywords about the general framework of that particular material and maybe my work in the recent years more generally. First of all, one important premise for me is the how our present situation, anthropogenic climate change, and I feel strongly that this climate change necessitates rethinking the role of academic scholarship. And what we need to do is we need to activate in the classrooms, and in my case, for example, I feel also this is necessary for my research, a deeper understanding of the fundamental thoroughgoing intertwining of human ideas, lives, and actions with natural environments. And for example, Dipesh Chakrabarty's work has been quite instrumental for me, even though there are very many other scholars who are working on that. And Chakrabarty's emphasis that we have been stuck in this distinction between natural history and human history, and this is something that needs to be overcome. So that it's not just that some people are doing environmental studies and other ones political or social studies, but that somehow there would be more of an overlap between these different projects. And then one way how to think about this potential overlap, what I have found useful is to think about multiscalarity of social phenomena. And this is the approach I've been using in my book. And for me, such an approach reveals how meaning-making unfolds through interaction across personal, phenomenological, local, regional, global, and planetary scales. And you will see in my talk how exactly what I mean by that. And part of that would be also understanding of subjecthood as multischolar, so that what we are as human persons, it is dependent on actually our very primary encounters with the world around us, but also wider circulations of ideas. And this recent article of mine opens up these premises. If anyone is interested, it is also open access, so very easy just to click and read. And so anthropogenic climate change, multiscalar approach, and then the third aspect for me is what you can just call intertwinings. And again, this is something you'll see today a lot, how one idea actually merges with a different idea and how they all together move in some third direction. And one of the conclusions I draw based on these different premises is that Soviet Union was not always and in all respects so very Soviet. We very easily say Soviet this and Soviet that. Well, I would caution, I would recommend to think twice every time when we see Soviet or say Soviet. And Sovietness was not necessarily the defining category in everyday life or in the circulation of ideas. And maybe I would call you now by listening to my talk to think, okay, where does this Sovietness fit in there? Because I don't use this word at all, not once. So, but that's a question for you. And just a small other preliminary remark, and this is something I would like to reach, the end point here. And I talked about this in the ACES newsletter from May. Again, this is open access available. And there my claim was that our present era is one of both Russia's new waves of imperial colonial warfare and of anthropogenic climate change. And my call has been to think about these things together. For example, how Russia's war against Ukraine actually also destroys Ukrainian natural environments, everything living, not just the Ukrainian people and their culture. All right, and then let's move to our topics. We want to talk about gender, about cybernetics, and about environmental issues. And our main focus will be in the late 1970s, but I want to start a little bit early, actually 2 decades earlier, because I'm just struck how in some ways actually 1950s is the start of 1970s. So this is just one page from a journal, Norus, Youth, meant for youth. You have one article which is titled Cybernetics, and another one which has a question in the title, does a person have to get married for sure?
Yeah.
And then in that very same issue of Norus, we also have a piece about Decameron, Boccaccio's Decameron, and this piece celebrates the fact that the whole book is now finally available in Estonian translation. And alas, in Bourgeois Estonia, before the Soviet rule, it was only partially translated with a subtitle, Erotic Tales. So this almost reads like an advertisement, right? But of course the article tells you that, well, this is actually high literature and we are not interested in eroticism only.
Yeah.
Yeah. And let's now, and let me also add this cybernetics article. This is 1957, and the year 1960 in Estonia, the Institute of Cybernetics is established. And cybernetics is just everywhere. And it becomes a reality, a way of doing research, not just some kind of a vague utopian thing. And now let's get to this kind of a core text that this talk today will circulate around. This is by M.A. Beckman, a novel which is titled Valiko Vimalus, Possibility of Choice, and is published in 1978. And as you see at the cover of this novel, we see a naked woman, and it has a calculator instead of her womb. So it's a woman, or is it a woman?
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a machine or something.
Yeah.
And this novel was quite controversial when it was published. And it then features the main character, Regina, who is a young woman who is approaching the age of 30. She's a school teacher, and at the beginning of the novel, she goes through a breakup with her lover. So this is a long-time relationship, and the lover just tells her in bed that actually he's about to get married to someone who is 18 years old and is 4 months pregnant. So that's a little bit of a shock for Regina, and she thinks like, okay, I need to make some changes in my life. Well, things are not going as I was intending them to go. And she makes this dramatic turn. She moves to the countryside, actually not countryside, but small provincial town. She happens to inherit quite a nice house built in the Soviet era, but still nice according to Soviet standards. She's amazed, like, wow, so much space. And she very easily gets a job. She had been teaching German language at school, and of course they are in need of a German teacher there. And as she's disillusioned with love and romantic notions of marital harmony, she's still determined to avoid this socially bizarre status assigned to single women. So she makes an unorthodox move. She proposes herself to a local drunk, and the drunk is surprised, but then accepts the offer conditionally, saying, okay, let's see how it works out, but yeah, let's go ahead of it. And then Regina conceives 3 children out of one-night stands with different men, because she is well aware that alcoholism could lead to birth defects or maybe even brain damage in children. And so that very smoothly all goes through. And in the end, at the end of the novel, she even thinks like, maybe I should have a 4th child with my own husband, who has developed into a model father. So it's not exactly your typical novel of a Soviet canon, as we tend to think about Soviet novels, right? And so in this particular novel, there are lots of comparisons made between Regina and kind of a cybernetic brain or cybernetic thinking. And she herself considers herself and her actions in these terms. For example, I quote here from the novel, "With her own savings book in hand, a new thought had automatically presented itself to Regina. Now I can feed into myself any program," she thought. The initial data were promising: a spacious house, garden for direct contact with nature, job at the good school. What more could she want? So, you know, this is our data, I am the program. Let's see what's going to come out of it. And I added this particular photo. This particular type of a house, the model was called Ants, which is a very typical Estonian maiden name. And this model was very common during the Soviet era. So you see these kind of houses in kolkhozes. Kolkhozes built these for their workers, or in small towns, but also in Tallinn and Tartu. And it reminds a little bit of a pre-Estonian, pre-Soviet type of a dwelling, so people liked it. So I bet it might have been a house like that where Regina moved. Or perhaps it was a little bit more spacious, but you know, here you go. This is a typical option here. And at the same time, Regina is constantly thinking and analyzing her actions in relation to the society around her. So we do have this sense of a society in crisis. Regina herself thinks about herself: am I a slag from an overheated cauldron of civilization? And he sees a set of symptomatic crises around her. It seems to her that people are poisoned with noise, addicted to constant stimulation. They moved along on a conveyor belt of easy pleasures. And this is all an era of superficiality. And she just, bypassingly mentions, like, yeah, this is urbanitis. People are suffering from urbanitis. And we can get a sense that this is a malady of urban life that makes people impatient, and fidgety and inclined to fill their days with meaningless quotidian trivialities. And those of you who are familiar with work by Jean Baudrillard about late capitalist society, I think there is a lot of similarity that's going on here. How this society becomes superficial, got modified, etc. And Regina also mentions that the pollution of water and air had created as if a permanent experiment, testing how much degradation human health could tolerate. And she thinks about her own choices in relation to that society in crisis. And an important figure that kind of paved way to this novel is this particular man, Gustav Nahn, who was born in Vladivostok and was sent to Estonia under the orders of the Communist Party to help to build up a new society in Estonia, and was a very dedicated Stalinist when she first arrived. However, after Stalin's death, he very cleverly switched gears, became quite popular for a period of time there, and he was the vice president of Estonian Academy of Science, and actually it was thanks to him and his relations in Moscow that the Estonian Institute of Cybernetics was founded and could be created. And he also promoted cybernetics quite extensively, and also wrote an introduction to Norbert Wiener's book, which was translated to Estonian. And this Norbert Wiener was then one of the major figures in cybernetics. His education was in physics. And he started also writing a lot about the gender, marital issues, and he claimed that he's using scientific approach. And he always talked against common norms of morality, promoted non-marital sexual relationships, and posed this question, don't unmarried women need love also? And just pointed out that there's so many divorces, and a great percentage of women actually are not married. And he especially attacked Christianity. He saw that there's a, or according to him, there were these common prejudices that paid it back to Christianity. So recreational function of sex life regarded as sin, sexual activity needs to be tied to marriage, sexual activities for youth, and then elevating the spiritual soul over the carnal, dirty flesh. And these are the arguments that he made at length in different articles in Estonian media. And one of the series of articles was published in 1976, 2 years before the publication of Bergman's novel. So I think we can quite easily see that maybe Nahn's ideas were one of the triggers for Bergman. And let me just show you one quote from the novel. Sexual life was made public. The problems of this sphere were chewed like gum. Why grow unnecessary complexes? Regina didn't know if she should regret the loss of the Lutheran false morality and restrictiveness. So this is almost like a quote from Gustav Nahn, right? Mm-hmm. The same themes. She could only observe that she happened to live in times of change. So she doesn't exactly know what's going on in the society, but she knows that her clock is ticking. If she wants to have family and children, she needs to act right now. So that's what she's doing. And about Gustav Nahn, he actually also published in Literaturnaya Gazeta, where there was an exchange about, okay, you know, why about marriages and why there are so many divorces. And here, Gustav Nahn's tone is way more subdued. His point is basically that, look, we need to not just, be, I mean, overly emotional about these issues, let's use scientific approach. So here he's using, he's comparing marriage to the second law of thermodynamics. And interestingly, Vladimir Slaventhal, who has written a monograph about sex and gender and marital relations in the Soviet Union, just is very fond of Gustav Nahn's writing. Mm. It's like, yes, that's just amazing. It's the best what was written about it. And just, you know, as a general, to provide some general perspective, and I assume, you know, maybe all of you know, or many of you know, the basic understanding how liberalization of sexual practices was treated by major dominant scholars, Anna Tyomkina and Elena Strava-Mislova. So what their material comes from Soviet Russia, and what they see is that there is a liberalization of sexual practices, definitely going on, but at the same time, this is lack of the public debate and everyday ignorance in sexual matters. And they call it hypocritical sexuality. And then they also pose this claim that in the late Soviet official public discourses, sexual life was represented in the frame of marriage. Well, as you see, this doesn't talk to Estonian situation at all, because indeed all these articles, also the responses to Gustav Nahn, they were all happening in major newsletters, in major newspapers and journals. All right, so that would be one thread that I was interested in following, and let's now follow the other one, urbanitis. So my question that I posed also in the talk of in the title of this talk: do you suffer from urbanitis? I think maybe people who are living in such beautiful place by the lake, maybe you suffer a little bit less from the urbanitis. Yeah. But when I was reading about it, I was wondering, am I in trouble because of urbanitis? And this term was first, at least I noticed the first use was from 1966, so more than 10 years before Bergman's novel. And this is Harry Yanes, he's a candidate in medicine, or basically like this kandidatska, Soviet version of PhD, even though there was also a doctorate degree. And he refers to World Health Organization publication, not giving any specifics there. And then urbanitis for Harry Yanes, this includes diseases and disorders of the nervous system, heart, circulatory system, digestive organs, and metabolism. And the causes of it is caused by rushing, transportation stress, noise pollution, everyday irritations, architectural monotony, highly refined foods, and polluted air. So it's a very long article, so you have lots of listing different causes. And it's a fatal condition. So it starts with chronic constipation, then there is weight gain, and then it's followed by premature death. Yes. Sorry, bad news. and he actually has a very extensive section about air and water pollution. If this were to continue, then soon the air of our planet will no longer be fit for breathing. However, he goes on to say, every day we need to spend at least 1.5 outdoors, and on the weekends it should be 3 or 4 hours. And well, how many of you living up to these standards?
Not winter.
Actually, yeah. And because I wanted to make this emphasis on multiscalarity, it's interesting for me how both Harry Yanes and many other people who are writing on these themes, they constantly bring in global comparisons. So obviously urbanitis cannot be Estonian or Soviet disease only. This is related to urbanization. Heino Tansiver writes a very lengthy article and draws data from Tokyo, London and New York, and just very casually compares New York and Moscow, how in terms of urbanization these processes look quite similar. And Harry Yanas brings in Perm and Moscow as negative examples, and he points out that in Perm only 17 trees or bushes have been planted over the course of 47 years. He doesn't give any reference, and of course Perm is quite far up north, so you do wonder what exactly does that kind of a claim do here. But I mean, this is a striking fact. And then in Moscow, the outskirts of Moscow, presumably nothing, no flowers are left blooming because people are just rushing everywhere and picking all the flowers everywhere. Harry Yanas salutes the 1960 California law, which requires cars to be equipped with a PCV valve, and thinks like, okay, we should actually perhaps do something similar. So what we see here clearly is that the world is seen as one common space grappling with a similar set of problems everywhere. So there's no iron curtain if we are talking about urbanization and other questions. And let's now also draw a little bit of parallels with other literary works that were published about the same era, and just very shortly. But that's a little bit striking for me. So Emer Bergman is married to Vladimir Bergman, who is the chair of Estonian Writers' Union. And Vladimir Bergman is chemist by education. And he has all kinds of connections, knows all kinds of things that are happening, and which perhaps not everyone is conscious of. And his novel is published 1 year later, The Year of the Donkey. And this is a dystopia about the destruction of an indigenous island community after their discovery of precious phosphate on their land. And it's really, the whole book is a critique of colonial extractivism, how non-local extractors are coming and starting to basically destroy this whole community. And as Bergman himself later shared, the whole novel was inspired by plans of the central government to start excavating phosphorite in Tolsa on the north coast of Estonia. And this was a project that was not publicly known, but Bergman knew about it, and Estonian scientists and local politicians really fought very hard against it and could postpone it. And then its reactivation triggered mass protests and was the first step in Estonian, we can call it, decolonization of the 1987-88. And then basically environmental concerns in Estonia indeed were related to phosphorite and oil shale mines. The one in Tolsa was not opened, the others were at work, and their ecological footprint was enormous. And then another side of it was military and social violence. And just one telling example here, a woman of the Soviet army had left in 1992. So you pump water from your well, and what you get is that that substance that can be burned. So we have lots of photos how people lighted the fire. The groundwater was just thoroughly polluted in that particular area, and in a quite extensive area. And then just as a quick reference, indeed there is this Estonian environmental movement that's going on in the background here. In 1957, Estonians had the first republic level conservation law in the Soviet Union, and 1966 was the founding of the Estonian Nature Conservation Society. And they had lots of this, you had tens of thousands of members, And they were quite active, and they had all kinds of outdoor gatherings. And you can see this is Jan Einaster, who was their long-term leader. And just to point out quickly one striking fact, if you just look at what were the themes that people were writing about. A death of bee populations, very common, one novel, one short story, one essay after other. So as if, you know, we think that this was maybe something that happened 10 years ago, started. Mm-hmm. Now it's a very old problem. And then oil spills and river pollution, for example, also. And we do have a very, very rich let's say collection of environmental visual arts. I just show you a few. This particular one is already from 1968, and Estonian art historians call this the inaugural event of Anthropocene art in Estonian art history, Fading Sun by Ilmar Malin. And you see this blackened sun, which recalls the shape of a nuclear mushroom cloud, and the earth below appears as a barren geological surface. Quite striking, isn't it? And many other images. This one, I want to have this as a cover image for my book. I think it's just incredibly beautiful and also very telling image. Basically, the whole earth has become a pile of trash. Yeah. And then this one for a fish. what's still left, and everyone of course tries to catch this one fish here. And then you have gloomier images of pollution, extraction of natural resources. And these are often references are made to Rachel Carson. Mm-hmm. His book The Silent Spring, which is considered the beginning of the modern environmental movement as a mass movement. And its full Estonian translation was out in 1968, and people talked and thought about it a lot. And just another very striking figure, which I haven't heard so much outside of the Baltics, that its impact was, or his impact was so big, but Albert Schweitzer and his ideas about reverence for life. How many of you have heard the name of Albert Schweitzer? Actually, that's very nice, yeah. Because many of my friends have not, outside of Estonia, have not heard it. And you see tens and tens and tens of references to Schweitzer's work and these ideas. And if we are talking about ethics as human beings, it needs to be ethical sense of unity with all nature. Very, very common idea in this particular era. And now I would want to, I actually have now one last section left of this talk, but I would like to share with you a small musical interlude. And this refers to one particular thread in this whole thinking about crisis environment. How urbanization has brought about an alienation from nature as a common phenomenon. And 70% of Estonians lived in cities or towns at that particular time now already. And this is Hando Runnel, very famous Estonian poet, and his very influential poetry collection came out the same year as Pelikman's novel. And just a few of the first lines. No longer does the soil offer much story for you once you learn to walk on barked floors. There nature and the story of creation are forgotten, and the sound of the fields fades from your ears. And I have it's available, studio recording of this particular song by a popular Head maybe? Yes,
here it is. Or Adam. Oh, you got it. Okay, thank you.
So Ruia was very, very, very popular, even though they were also banned most of the time. Yes, and now the last thread of global impact to Estonian thought pertains to the limits to growth publication, and I think this is probably something that many of you have heard. So in 1968, international think tank seeking to address global problems called the Club of Rome was established, and their first report was published in 1972, and this was a result of computer modeling led by MIT scholars with an aim to predict possible global scenarios for the future, and it was quite gloomy. So and here's some of the Estonian summaries of them. First one that I saw was from 1974, and this was a text that was not, I think that clearly there was some kind of a Soviet ban, like how you can talk about it. Vella Pohla, who is a lecturer in social sciences, member of the Communist Party, goes to Moscow to Lomonosov Institute course for raising the qualification of lecturers in social sciences, and they had one thematic set of lectures there about environmental issues, and they talk about these limits to growth publication. And Vella Pohla's summary in Estonian media is then the following. It argues the report argues that unless within the next 10 years there can be instituted radical changes in human thinking, social life, reproduction, etc., then any possible framework of functionality for human life on Earth will be headed for collapse by 2100. And Jaak Allik talks about another person who is related to, is a member of a Communist Party. There was clearly a selection who could talk about these issues. And he points out limits will be reached within the 100 years. This was one thing people talking about, particularly about the limit to growth report. But then other articles, some others do not refer to the report, but the tenor is quite similar. So, and here in that particular article, what strikes me that it's published in the same number of journal Loaming where Beckmann's novel is initially published. And the title is Evolution with or without human beings. And he just coolly observes that the consequences of human activity threaten to eliminate the necessary biological prerequisites for the existence of humanity. And in the event that humanity should fail to avoid an ecological catastrophe, biological evolution continues only without Homo sapiens. Surely everyone was very happy to hear that. So, and this one is especially interesting. In 1979, in Tallinn, an international symposium takes place in preparation for the United Nations conference, which was supposed to then, or which happened in August 1979. And this Tallinn symposium was organized jointly by the United Nations Advisory Committee and by the USSR State Committee on Science and Technology. And it was quite a high-level event. Walter Clements provides some information based on archival research in the United States, that one of the more than 50 foreigners invited, many were associated either with the International Institute for Applied System Analysis, which was a shared think tank and institution which where you had Soviet and Western scholars working together, or were associated by the Club of Rome, and then there were officials from the United Nations Environmental Programme. And here is one summary of that event in an Estonian journal, Eesti Loodus. The scientists, including Club of Rome members, politicians and administrators, were united in their understanding that humanity was, in some sense, approaching a limit in its evolution, a limit that demanded change from its old ways. 1979.
Yes, and interestingly, Matti Junt, who is a writer, a famous, well-known Estonian writer, who has no interest in environmental issues at all, is a very urbanized figure. He actually likes to write like, I hate, just being outdoors because it's uncomfortable. There's flies flying around, etc. But he writes this survey article, Service 10, titled Issued by the Club of Rome, and summarizes then that in the early 70s, the Club of Rome was regarded as a scaremonger, but now they tried to outdo it in an ever-escalating pessimism. And indeed, it is hard to be an optimist when you hear, for example, the tropical rainforests are being destroyed at the rate of 50 hectares per minute. And then Unt quotes Aurelia Petsi, the president of the Club of Rome, the 80s will be the decisive decade. We need to rectify the present situation in which rich white men are making all the decisions. Well, yes. And Matti Unt likes cataloging facts, so he also provides this long list of global crises, different ways how you can articulate it. So global problems, as you see it in the discourse of the era, uncontrollable population growth, ethnic conflicts, social injustice, hunger, malnutrition, poverty, unemployment, obsession of growth, inflation, energy crisis, democracy crisis, currency crisis, protectionism, illiteracy, outdated education, youth rebellion, alienation, urban growth and decline, crime, rural population, drugs, air pollution, violence, disregard for human rights, abuse of law, atomic obsession, political corruption, bureaucracy, militarism, decline in faith and morality, general uncertainty. And Beckmann's character, Regina, would have happily signed that list.
Well, to move towards conclusions here, what then happened in the 1980s? Mm-hmm. I mean, we are all building towards 1980s are the decisive decade. Afterwards, this we are doomed. What happened? Nothing, right? I mean, things happened. What happened? War in Afghanistan. And some of these joint programs, that was the end of it. So, for example, the IIACA and ASA, which also participated in Tallinn Symposium, they could not get funding anymore from the American side, and that ceased to exist. Then we have, of course, Ronald Reagan era, or Reagan-Thatcher era. Mm-hmm. We have the idea that we, Reagan's idea, or that we need to spend military, increase military spending so that we can outspend the Soviets. And then generally the era of neoliberalism, again Reagan, Thatcher era, this is what it's famous for, it's the start then. And future modeling is happening, these institutions are in place, but they are more interested in how to use this knowledge and these computers in economic terms and you know, free markets, profit making. These are the keywords of the era. And in Estonian story is an interesting, you might, okay, this is my 45 minutes, well, and I'm almost done.
No, it's fine. Yeah. My introduction took at least 5 minutes, so take all the time you need.
Yeah, I'm actually wrapping up here too. So in 1983, it's kind of the next phase in Estonian thinking about limits to growth report. And Savisaar, Edgar Savisaar, and Lembit Vald first published a series of articles and then also a book, 1983, Global Problems and Future Scenarios. And Savisaar's dissertation is actually on the social philosophical foundations of the global models of global growth. And now what's interesting is that Savisaar became one of the leading figures in Estonia in the early stages of Perestroika. And he was the one who initiated public discussions about Estonia's economic self-governance. So future modeling is a very, very popular, active thing in Estonia, but it's now used for economics and for state planning. And not environmental themes kind of fade into a different track of thinking. And as a conclusion, this would be my short proposal for how to think about the present era. And we hear lots of people like to think like, okay, it looks right now as if we are on the verge of the Second World War. People are drawing parallels with this period before the Second World War. I would propose a more optimistic parallel. I think we can see lots of parallels between 1981 and 2024. Again, this is an era where money goes to buying more and more weapons. And the Estonian Prime Minister has been very powerful in trying to get this message through. Estonian defense spending this year amounts to 3.21% of the GDP. And Kaja Kallas has to admit that not all European countries are thinking that spending on weapons is the most important thing, but they are coming around to that fact and that situation, which is of course caused by the Russia's military aggression war against Ukraine and earlier developments already. And perhaps what this, if we think about this particular parallel, I just like it more because then the end would be in sight somewhere. Then we would not be facing the Third World War soon, but there is some hope that after 1981 we are reaching 87, 88, 89, and more hopeful 1990s. And let's finish here today with that little bit of a hopeful tone. I don't know how hopeful exactly it is. Mm-hmm. There's probably more to be pessimistic. But thank you.
Okay.